from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. The writer George Saunders gave a graduation speech that went viral recently. In it, he noted that his biggest regrets in life were the times when he failed to meet those everyday tests of kindness. Like the time 42 years earlier when he wasn't kind enough to an awkward girl in the seventh grade. So imagine you're standing in line at the grocery store. You're pressed for time when a young mom gets in line behind you. She's holding a crying baby and looking overwhelmed. You feel like you should consider trading places with her, and then you notice her shopping cart is really full. What do you do? Considering kindness after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Every so often, a graduation speech touches a chord, resonates in some way that gets people talking. That's what's happened in recent weeks with a speech the author George Saunders gave at Syracuse University. In it, he notes that one useful thing old folks can tell young college grads is what they regret. And so he told the Syracuse grads this story. He regretted that he had not been kind enough to an awkward seventh grade girl 42 years before. Indeed, he went on to say, "What I regret most in my life are my failures of kindness." It's a beautiful speech, funny, poignant, a meditation on why kindness counts and what gets in our way. And it offers, as all graduation speeches should, a little bit of useful advice. He said, "It's a little facile, maybe, and certainly hard to implement. But I'd say as a goal in life, you could do worse than try to be kinder." And that's our topic this hour of Forum, Finding Our Way to Kindness. What is it that George Saunders said that caused that speech to have such a reaction? What does it say to you? We're going to talk about the matter of kindness, why it does matter, and what the obstacles are that get in our way during this hour of Forum. And joining us to lend his perspective on this is Dacher Keltner. He's a professor of psychology and the co-founder of the Greater Good Science Center at the University of California, Berkeley. His books include Born to Be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life. Dacher Keltner, good morning.
Good morning, Dave. It's great to be here.
Pleasure to have you here. Why do you think that this has had the kind of viral effect that it's had? What is it about this topic that you think is making people respond to it in such a deep way?
Well, I think it's a really encouraging development, and I think this really wonderful speech has been viral for a couple of reasons. And one is, you know, the social science reveals that the past 30 years we've really been in an era where we think that greed is good, right? And young people think that they'll find happiness through materialism in the pursuit of greed, and all the scientific studies suggest that that may be a misguided endeavor. And I think young people and people like you and I are hungry for new messages. And I think Saunders hit it on the head, which is let's think about all the ways in which we can practice and cultivate kindness.
It makes such intuitive sense, but you're also saying the science tells us that. What do we know from science about the good that kindness does for ourselves and for others?
Well, this is one of the oldest questions in science, and it's just a growth area in our field. You know, when we study kindness, we think about many different kinds of things, right? We think about noble acts of altruism. We think about volunteerism, which 31% of Americans do on a regular basis. We think about how young kids will help somebody in need as early as 16 months of age. We think about kind of the everyday stuff that Saunders was really after, I think, which is, you know, do you look someone in the eye when you open the door for them? Do you change your tone of voice when you speak to them? And what we're learning, Dave, and it really is incredible, is that, and it really helps us understand why Saunders' speech is so viral, is that really small acts of kindness are very powerfully viral, and they spread through social networks and tilt us in a way in the direction, as he says in his speech, of goodness.
Is it measurable? I mean, can you tell by what happens inside the body, inside the brain? Do we have a way of saying, this had this effect?
Yeah. You've hit upon one of the hottest questions in neuroscience, right? So for 50 years, and I suspect your listeners know a lot about cortisol and stress and blood pressure and all the effects that fight or flight has on our nervous system in the brain and then in the body. And more recently, various neuroscientists like Shelley Taylor down at UCLA and in our lab as well, we've been really interested in charting where is kindness measurable and in the body, perhaps shaped by evolution. And what we know is there are really old parts of the brain, the mammalian brain, that activate when we feel compassion. We know that oxytocin, this amazing neuropeptide that floats in your brain and in your bloodstream, it's involved in milk letdown and uterine contractions, helps us be kind. We also know the vagus nerve, which I study in our lab at Berkeley with my grad students, is really involved. It's a bundle of nerves that's in your chest, slows down heart rate, and it really seems to be triggered by kindness. So it's in the body.
Can you define it for us, Decker? I mean, what the it is?
Yeah, that's tough. And you are asking a question that has provoked all sorts of theoretical debate, right? So how I think about kindness is it really is a family of actions that are defined by being interested in elevating the welfare of somebody else, right? And then when you add sacrifice to it, it becomes altruism. When you add kind of a broader affection to it, it becomes this ethical idea of love of humanity. But it really is about doing things that lift up the welfare of others.
And can that be as simple as looking someone in the eye, really listening to someone, that it is an act that says, I'm paying attention?
Yeah. I love your description, Dave, and I think but I wouldn't call those simple acts. They're old, ancient acts in our repertoire of kind behaviors, looking people in the eye, nodding your head, which is an old signal of cooperation, using kind tones of voice. And it is very simple, and it's almost a pervasive layer of our social interactions.
We posted on our Facebook page this question and asked our listeners to finish this thought. Kindness is... Here are some of the things that people wrote in. Kindness is, Paul wrote, liberating. Sarah, listening. Jennifer, kindness is not contrived. Dale, a choice. John, a liability. Jan, infrequent. Lara, sometimes too hard to come by. So you see this conflicted kind of response in a way, both what it is and also how it's lacking.
Yeah, it's a struggle.
It's not easy.
No, it is not easy, but sometimes it's deceptively easy. So let's take a couple of the observations, and I think they really capture some of our culture's grappling with how we conceptualize and cultivate kindness. You know, John's point, it's a liability, is... that's a very deep vein of thought, and there's a lot of skepticism in some of the most influential thinkers in Western thought about kindness, right? Mm-hmm. So Immanuel Kant, the great philosopher, said kindness, compassion are just blind. They're just inherently biased. They lead you astray. Ayn Rand said if civilization is to survive, it is the morality of altruism or kindness we have to reject. And we have this common notion that when we're kind, we're suckers, right? Or we're exploited or we're taken advantage of. That turns out not to be true in most of the social scientific studies.
So I gave this example in the promo for this program that I'd just like to run by you, which is you're standing in line, you're pressed for time, you're late at the grocery store, and someone comes up right behind you, and it turns out it's a young mom who's with a crying child, and she's looking totally overwhelmed, and you feel like you should trade places with her. And then you notice that her grocery cart is like really full. Yeah. Does it matter how you respond? Is there a right answer to that sort of kindness question?
Well, you know, I think, I would go back to what Saunders said in his graduation speech, which is, you know, why not just err in the direction of kindness? Mm-hmm. And even if there are mistakes that you make and, you're late to work because it's requiring more help than what you had anticipated, it's a pretty good error to make. Whether it's right or wrong, I think that there is a good deal of consensus in the writings of people like Karen Armstrong, the religious historian, and then Martha Nussbaum, the philosopher, surveying Western and Eastern thought, saying we do pretty well when we practice kindness. You might even call it a moral right.
Decker Keltner is our guest. He's professor of psychology and co-founder of the Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley. His books include Born to be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this topic this morning. Our listeners, if you'd like to post your own definitions of kindness, we'd love to see them. If you'd like to post your thoughts on regrets you might have about when you didn't act in a way you wish you had, we'd love to hear those stories as well. And we'll get to your calls, too, on this topic in just a little bit. I want to ask something about the question of regret and how that ties into this, Decker. In Jer Saunders' speech, again, he says that, you know, one useful thing that older people can do for younger is to say, tell them what you regret, and that they'll usually tell you whether you ask them or not. But I'll just read this portion of this speech where he says, so what do I regret? Being poor from time to time? Not really. Working terrible jobs like being a knuckle puller in a slaughterhouse and don't even ask what that entails? No, I don't regret that. Skinny dipping in a river in Sumatra and looking up and seeing 300 monkeys sitting on a pipeline pooping into the river and getting deathly ill afterwards? No, don't regret that so much. But here's what I regret. In seventh grade, this new kid joined our class. She wore blue cat's eye glasses at the time only old ladies wore. She was nervous pretty much all the time, and she had a habit of chewing on a strand of hair. When she came to school, she was mostly ignored, occasionally teased. And then they moved. That was it. No tragedy, no big deal. One day she was there, one day she wasn't. End of story. So why do I regret that 42 years later? What do you think about that and about the importance of regretting and something that's small, that's so stayed with George Saunders for four decades?
Yeah, that was one of my favorite parts of his speech as well. And I think that it really prompts us to rethink the nature of regret, right? And we often think of regret as being about the pleasures that we didn't ever get to enjoy. You know, I never got to go to the Yucatan or have a fancy meal or whatever it is. And I think he's really saying the human mind may be different, which is that we're really attuned to being kind and failures to not be kind when the context would call for it are really what may stick with us most as we live life. And I think he's really onto something very deep, that we care enormously about kindness. It's just wired into what we deem important. And later in life, those things surface. And when I read that passage, I had my own similar reflections of things where I could have been more kind that I didn't.
Such as?
Well, it was striking. There was a girl very similar to the girl he described, who was teased a lot in my seventh and eighth grade class, who was from a complicated family, and I didn't step in and defend her as much as I could have. My brother did, which was a great lesson, but I did not. And I think about that regularly.
So is regret useful if you keep it kind of in front of you? You know, the 51st Psalm has a line which is, my sin is ever before me. That you think of that and sort of, and I'm now illustrating my own Catholic childhood, but that's guilt is not, you know, you shouldn't beat yourself up, blah, blah, blah. But in some ways, is that useful to sort of have something ever before you?
I do. I think that the social science is starting to lead to a revision of the typical Californian's approach to regret, which is, and guilt as well, which is, these are emotions, very poignant emotions that almost act like our own internal surveillance system, right? And they keep us honest and they make us realize, even though we tend to look upon ourselves favorably, very often we hurt people as part of social lives, and and guilt and regret make us better in that regard.
We have listeners who want to join in our conversation. I think this is the kind of program where it would be great to hear people talk about their own experience, their own regrets, their own sense of why kindness matters. So let's involve people who are tuning into us this morning. Jim in San Francisco has something he'd like to say. Jim, go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. This is a great topic, and I've been thinking about this a lot lately. I just finished reading a book called Humans Need Three Hands, and this author in the novel is talking about this ranger that goes out to protect wildlife in the Pacific and is constantly confronted by humans that obstruct him. And the whole point is that greed is bad and altruism is good, and how do we convince society that it's the anonymous flock, as Conrad Lorenz puts it, the anonymous flock that is like the basis of the colony or the basis of the society, not the individual and not the family, but actually all the cars going down the freeway at the same time in unison, like that type of a thing. How do we convince people that it makes much more sense in a capitalistic society like America to be altruistic and help people than to be greedy and help yourself?
Jim, thank you.
Well, it's a great, and I love the connection to Conrad Lorenz. So I think that's part of why George Saunders' essay was so viral, because it is this very personal and poignant argument on behalf of kindness. And you know, what I think we're seeing is all sorts of movements away from greed and towards kindness. Things like Kiva and some of the social networks that are devoted to giving resources to those in need. So there are multiple ways in which we can cultivate kindness. We can do it through, you know, and we've talked about it in the show, through volunteerism, through giving to charity, through everyday acts. And I think there's a trend in that direction.
But does it mean that being successful and caring about what you achieve professionally and being committed to that and wanting to do well financially so you can support your family, those don't have to be mutually exclusive.
They don't. And I think that, you know, what we're learning is, and that's also a really important argument for young people, for example, as they think about devoting themselves to kinds of charity or kindness, which is, kindness has all sorts of benefits to self-interest, right? So we know from scientific studies that when I give to charity, the reward circuit in my brain lights up. It actually is inherently pleasurable. We know people who volunteer in the last 3 or 4 decades of their life, more than 14 hours a week, they actually are 40% less likely to die a decade later. So there are all sorts of selfish benefits to kindness.
Does that take away from if your motive is less than pure, if you're saying, I'm writing this check to my favorite charity because I know it's going to do something for me, does that limit its importance?
Well, you know, there are two schools of thought on that. And one is you want people to act altruistically out of pure motives, right? And it should be pure compassion that really drives altruism, and any self-interest kind of clouds the interpretation of that act. There's another school of thought that says, well, you know, we'll take any form of generosity no matter what the motive. And I tend to sort of like that second school of thought. Let's cultivate more altruism.
There's another aspect to this that Saunders wrote about in his speech, which I think is interesting, in which he makes the point that you can aspire to what you might want professionally and that isn't doesn't yeah. exclude being kind. He said, if we're going to become kinder, that process has to include taking ourselves seriously as doers, as accomplishers, as dreamers. We have to do that to be our best selves. So that, which I like that idea that we want to be our best self. And that means giving whatever it is we want to give professionally, perhaps, but that these are all part of the whole of being your best self.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that it's a really delicate balance that we strike as we move through life, which is, you know, asserting yourself and acting in ways that honor the talents you have and perhaps making a lot of money at that and really complementing that with a practice of kindness. And what I would argue is that, and I think, you know, Saunders comes out of a Buddhist tradition, and you see this in his writing and then in other forms of Buddhism, which in some ways our best self is to be compassionate. Our neuroscientific studies suggest compassion is a very old part of our brain and the neurochemical pathways in our body. And so maybe those two are closer than we might imagine, that being our best self is about being kind.
Hmm. Let's hear from another one of our listeners this morning. Theo joins us from Berkeley. Theo, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Kind to me is peace of mind. It's natural. It's something that builds in, something that makes us human. And my mind goes back almost 70 years ago as a Holocaust survivor, as a child dying by starvation. Another child dying at the same time, he had a little food and shared it with me. And I said, that's it. That's the answer to become winners. That's the answer to solve all the human problems. A little child in my same situation, I lost 5 brothers from starvation, and said, that's it. And then since then, I'm the happiest person on earth. I have peace of mind. I sleep like a baby. Nothing will ever bother me because I find the answer to what human is all about. It just kind is that's all, especially the today's society, and it's just sharing, not expecting any reward, because it makes you feel great, makes you feel good, makes you feel human. And that's all I wanted to say.
Thank you for saying it, Theo. That's an extraordinary story. Thanks so much for calling and participating in our program. That happened to him 70 years ago, and it sustained him, literally, and beyond.
Yeah, you know, I could not agree more with what Theo said, and I think what a really telling reflection upon kindness. It's natural. It makes you feel good. You know, there's this incredible book. It's written by a historian called Humanity, and it's this in-depth portrayal of something that happens in wartime, which is that very often when adversaries come face to face with each other and they're ready to kill each other, they literally collapse in what this historian calls sympathy breakthroughs. And we find kindness in the most unlikely circumstances. Yeah. And that tells us it's a very powerful part of human nature, as Theo was saying.
We have to take a short break, but give us some sense, Decker, before we go away, about then what gets in the way. If it is that powerful, if it can exist even in a concentration camp, as Theo described, what gets in the way?
Well, many facets of modern life, right? Being rushed gets in the way. Watching video games gets in the way. Thinking about money too much gets in the way. I think our listeners will have a lot of observations about that, and it's really important to think about how we structure our lives for more opportunities for kindness.
So it's as simple as thinking about, yes, if I trade places with this woman behind me in the grocery line, I'm going to be 3 minutes later. Gee, maybe I could manage that.
Yeah. I mean, often it's that simple.
Decker Keltner joins us. He is, again, a professor of psychology at the UC Berkeley, co-founder of the Greater Good Science Center. His books include Born to Be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life. As we consider this topic of kindness and why it matters so in our lives, we'd love to have you join our conversation. You can do so at 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or post your thoughts on our Facebook page, and we'll incorporate as many of those as we can. What is your own definition of kindness? What regrets might you have about a time when you weren't kind enough? How do you define what it actually is? Here's a definition from Henry James. 3 things in human life are important. The first is to be kind. The second is to be kind. And the third is to be kind. What do you think about kindness? How has it shaped your life? When do you wish you might have been kinder? Join us at 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or post your thoughts on our Facebook page. Here's some of what people have posted so far. Kindness is contagious. Kindness is therapeutic. Kindness is always in style. More in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, kindness and the extraordinary effect that a speech George Saunders gave at Syracuse University this graduation season about, in the end, if you can err on the side of kindness, his message was, you could do a lot worse. And we're talking about that this morning with Decker Keltner, who is a professor of psychology at UC Berkeley and co-founder of their Greater Good Science Center. We'd love to have you participate in our conversation too, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. Tony writes, I was cleaning up my soiled three-year-old in a mall restroom when a pair of punk guys busted into the bathroom stall I was in to cause trouble. I looked at them and said, you know, years from now, you're going to be a dad helping your kid. So I hope you're as kind to me as I hope you will be. They thought about it and walked away. What does that say to you?
Well, I mean, what it says is, A, you know, and I think Saunders writes about this, that, you know, there is this great struggle in life between, you know, self-interest and acting out on your impulses and then honoring that other impulse of kindness that that this father really astutely played out. And the other, I think the thing that it says is, and you know, Karen Armstrong has really made this point very persuasively that to be kind and to encourage kindness is a really powerful argument. And in just about every way that we sort of spread this idea, be it through literature or poetry or quoting Henry James or whatever the case may be, it's persuasive in just about every culture studied. And I think if you can persuade some punks in a bathroom, you can spread the idea.
Here's one from Plato that I pulled out earlier this morning. Be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a harder battle, which is really about sort of saying and realizing that we exist together and we need to pay attention to the struggles that other people have, and that's a great connecting form of connection.
Yeah, and one of the deepest questions that you can ask, and Saunders writes about this in the essay, and I suspect a lot of listeners are interested in it, is, you know, how do I cultivate this in myself, right? It's hard, and other thoughts come into the mind. How do I cultivate this in my teenager, right? I'm not sure about that one. But, you know, what we've learned is if you reflect on the suffering of others, right, and just remind yourself that you're not alone in your pain and your trials and tribulations, and you think about how others suffer, a Buddhist thought, it's a strong pathway to kindness.
Evan in Mill Valley wants to engage in our conversation. Evan, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Thank you for having me. I'm actually just about to touch on what you two just talked about the punks in the bathroom versus, you know, looking back and regretting, because I'm a younger guy. And I'm wondering if there's a difference to you between being kind in your personal life and being kind in your professional life, because, you know, I want to go into business and that kind of thing. And I see a lot of successful people who aren't very kind, but they're successful. And so do you think there's a divide between, you know, trying to get things done professionally and being a nice person in your personal life?
Fabulous question, Evan. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, that and it's one of the more complicated questions, right? Does kindness really yield you benefits, and is it a good thing in one context but not another? And I think there's this widespread notion that kindness is great for your kids or, you know, when you're playing softball with your friends or whatever the case may be. And it really is a misguided strategy in the cutthroat world of work. And that turns out to be a misconception. There's a fellow, there are about 70 studies that have looked at, do you rise in the ranks at work, right? And these are scientists who have studied success in economic sectors and hedge fund groups and even in the military. And what they find is that kindness helps you a little bit in rising to power and being successful. But where it really helps you is in keeping your power, right? It's one of these really important qualities embodied by someone like Abe Lincoln that helps you succeed and have enduring success. So practice it everywhere.
Let me tell you a little story, Evan, about someone who I have enormous admiration for professionally, but also personally. He was vice president of CBS News, good friend of mine, now man in his 80s. He was Walter Cronkite's producer, legendary person in news, a top of his game throughout his professional life as a journalist, but also the kindest man I have ever known, who did good deeds every weekend helping the homeless, but who had a kind of luminous quality about him. Whenever he was in the room, people drifted to him and wanted to be around him. It wasn't just because he was Walter Cronkite's producer or was this legendary figure at CBS News. It's because of who he was and the way in which he paid attention to you if you were the youngest intern in the journalism school. He looked at you like you counted and that there was no one else he'd rather talk to than you. So that's my story. Kate in Inverness joins us next. Kate, go ahead.
Thank you so much for this opportunity. I sing with a choir that, when invited, sings at the bedsides of people who are dying. And we've noticed that this act of kindness, actually we call it kindness made audible, we've noticed that it heals us even as we are offering this service to the people that invite us to sing for them. And I think that's a really important notion about kindness.
Kate, thank you.
Yeah, no, and I love two observations there, Kate. You know, one is that, as we've talked a little bit, you know, acts of generosity stimulate what we've been calling this pro-social nervous system, which is reward circuits in the brain and oxytocin and vagus nerve activation. And that just feels good and it makes you robust. And the other is the connection between art and kindness and the notion that Saunders writes about, that reading a piece of fiction or standing in front of a terrific painting or singing may be one of the most powerful pathways to kindness. And I think your story tells us that.
Kate, thank you. And we'd like more of your stories. So you can join us at 866-733-6786 and email them to us as well or post them on your Facebook, our Facebook page. Here are a couple of more. Aaron from Oakland writes, "Being a parent has made me more kind. Being exhausted, covered in spit up, trying to make it through a day with a small baby. I remember those that helped me. Smiles when I was dealing with temper tantrums. People who were more patient. Old ladies who told me what a beautiful child I had. People who picked up things I dropped in my tired state." There is something about the experience of being a parent, I think, that that helps you receive kindness, but it also changes kind of your direction because when you become a parent, you really are suddenly much more concerned about how your little person is doing than you are yourself. In fact, if you had to make a choice, you'd much rather have your child do well.
Yeah, you know, and that's a really important argument that we see in the sciences as well. You know, Charles Darwin argued that, and people, a lot of people don't know this.
Yeah, survival of the fittest
right.
is what we think.
That's not his quote, right? That's Spencer. So Darwin, in The Descent of Man, said that sympathy is our strongest instinct because communities that have sympathetic members will flourish and survive. Darwin, like Aaron, was a devoted parent and had 10 kids and came to this notion that sympathy is right at the core of human nature when one of his daughters passed away early and realized this is this strong instinct, and there are a lot of good reasons for why parenting brought about kindness.
John in San Francisco joins us. John.
Oh, hello. This is a wonderful program. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And everything you've been talking about for the last 45 minutes is the essence of what AA is all about, you know, kindness, warmth, welcoming others, the people who are on the dredges of humanity. They walk into the AA rooms, and they're met with kindness and love and understanding because all the people in those rooms have been there before themselves, have been through exactly the same thing. And I'll give you a personal example of my own experience. I have 30 years. I'm clean and sober for 30 years now. But when I was a young man in my early 20s, I fathered a child. And it had always bothered me, you know, what happened to that kid who was adopted, blah, blah, blah. And so when I got sober, through Alcoholics Anonymous and members who had been through the same thing, I contacted lawyers and search parties and computer experts, and they tracked the child down. She was living in another state, and I wrote her a letter, told her who I was and the circumstances of her mother and I, what happened, and then I went to meet her. And she had a child of her own. And it turns out that it wasn't a Walt Disney ending. She was a drug addict herself. But because of what I learned in AA, she's making steps to get clean and sober herself. And it never would have happened if I didn't walk into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is all about kindness and making up for past amends. And and being loving, you know, which is impossible to do when you're a practicing alcoholic or a drug addict, because it's about self-involvement.
Yeah. John, what a story. Thank you. Thanks so much, really, for having the courage to call and tell.
Thank you for what you're talking about. This is so important for people.
Yeah.
It really is. Thanks.
Thanks, John. Thank you.
Well, I was moved by John's statement, and I think there are a couple things to say. And one is, that very often the problems in our lives and when we are struggling to adapt to our circumstances are really problems where we're not being kind enough, right? Or we're not being kind to ourselves. And there's a whole new literature on self-compassion that I think John touched upon. And the other thing is, with respect to AA, just about every time groups of people get together in some kind of subculture or culture, and they think about ways to organize themselves, you find kindness right at the center of that organization.
I imagine there are some people listening now who think, this sounds sweet and yeah. nice and squishy and la-da-da, but, life is tough. And
yeah.
you got to be tough sometimes.
Absolutely.
And you got to deal with hard stuff. And sometimes that means saying things that aren't perhaps kind, that you have to confront certain difficult things in your life. You cannot just be Mr. Rogers.
Yeah. Yeah. And I hope our listeners wouldn't take that away from the show, but I think that that is a concern. And how I would approach the question is, the literature would say that the more kindness you practice, the more benefits you and others derive. So it's a pretty good strategy, as Saunders argues. But evolution has equipped us with a whole set of strategies. And let's not forget, it's essential to take care of the self. It's essential to be competitive at times. It's essential to be strong. So kindness is really one part of a very important story.
Lynn writes, as a teen, I was at boarding school in the United Kingdom while my parents were in the Far East. Three times a year, I made the trip on my own, home and back. One trip, I only had enough money for dinner or headphones on the very long trip. We had to pay for them then. I decided that I had to eat, so I took a seat at the counter and was shortly engaged in a conversation with an older couple nearby. After they left and when I went to pay for my meal, I found that they had paid for me. As a parent of teens 40 years later, I have always tried to pass it forward in whatever way I can. People haven't always been kind to me, but my experiences have convinced me that there is such a thing. Great story. Irene writes, I was a new girl in school. It's interesting how so many of these start with school, don't they? Kind of in that sort of awkward, painful coming of age time.
Seventh and eighth grade.
Irene writes, I was a new girl in school. I was teased and mocked. And 15 years later, that pain still affects my life. However, that negative experience allows me today to look at people from a different perspective. Every day I smile when I open the door for someone. I engage in small talk. I care for people. Because I know that a little gesture of kindness and care can make you feel safe. Carrie in San Francisco. Go ahead, please.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air, Carrie. Go ahead.
Hi there. I was just calling because especially the story that both of you told in the beginning, I actually had my bully from fifth grade. I was friends with a group of kids, and, one day you're in and the next day you're out, and I became the person to pick on. And it lasted for at least, 2 years. It was pretty mortifying. And when I was in college, I got a phone call from the boy who had been the worst out of everybody. And he had called my mother, found my number, and called me at college to apologize and said that he felt truly horrible about what he had done and he had hoped that it hadn't hurt me in the long run and that he felt badly about it and he wanted to, make sure that I was doing okay. And it really changed. It changed a lot. I mean, it took that wound and just kind of completely healed it and then flipped it around. And then last year I went to my high school reunion 20 years later, and that same group of people were not only welcoming and loving, but they actually had a small pre-party and invited me to that. And they all apologized and said that they thought that they just didn't understand how cool of a person I was as a kid because I was a lot more mature than they were at the time.
Hmm.
And they all apologized. And it was a phenomenally healing experience. And I was always friends with all the outcasts and the nerds and the geeks because I felt for them much more than I felt for the people that I, quote unquote, sort of belonged with.
Thank you, Carrie. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks for telling that story. Here's a question from Lisa. How do I navigate being kind to men without it being responded to with some unwanted or inappropriate sexual attention, as often seems to happen?
That's a whole other show. We know that, and everybody knows this, but scientific studies have found, you know, men tend to read sexual interest or intention in all sorts of gestures, including just simple acts of affection or friendship. And, and all I can say, although I'd prefer a woman to offer wisdom here, is, you know, clear boundaries and avoid certain signals. So,
Glenn from Oakland writes in, or no, rather, sorry, here's a whole series of emails and comments from our request to have you complete the sentence. Kindness is... People equate avoiding conflict with kindness, and this is a disaster because it leads to people never calling out bad behavior. Cowards, I think, sometimes hide behind the shield of kindness, writes another. So it's interesting. Kindness versus avoiding conflict.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's one of the – whenever we start to debate the ethical implications of kindness, that's a classic one, which is – you know, what do you do with people who are really acting in horrible ways, right? Or what do you do with somebody who's in your workplace who's really undermining efforts? And, you know, I always refer back to something that the Dalai Lama says when he talks about compassion, which is there's also tough compassion, which is you call it out, you confront it, you're honest, you're transparent, because ultimately it's in the service not only of your group, who the individual is undermining, but also that person, right? So I think as we practice kindness, you get this broader sense that it's not just in the moment, that it's about, you know, sort of helping someone in a broader trajectory.
Which might be the hardest act of kindness of all, to say to someone, particularly perhaps if it's someone you care about, to say, to confront, but confront with a kind of kindness. Because otherwise, that person's never going to see that part of who they are.
Yeah, exactly right. And it also tells us that kindness isn't always soft and isn't always weak. It's often tough, and it often leads you right into the struggles of life.
Mark in San Francisco has a comment. Mark, go ahead, please.
Hello there. Can you hear me?
Yep, you're on the air.
Thank you very much for this program. It's wonderful and fascinating. So I'm... one of the lucky ones who gets to make his living in the world of being hospitable to people as a tour director and a tour guide. So I get to explore kindness both in my own activities and in the group's activities, sometimes as a conversation with people as we travel. But in my case, learning kindness as a young 20-something-year-old boy, I explored it through kind of a ministry and Christian perspective in what Jesus would have done. So I've learned a lot of things about the conversation from that particular place. But my thought these days is it appears that there isn't any kind of contemporary cultural figure, you know, other than the really large one, like the Mother Teresa's and the Dalai Lama's and the Gandhi's, there isn't a contemporary cultural figure that, you know, expresses kindness and shows young people what it actually can look like, whether it's a kind no or a kind yes. You know, maybe it's only someone like Leonard on the Big Bang Theory who was an example of kindness. But as a child, I saw Brady Bunches and other kinds of fun bonanza-like television programs that had kindness as an element of their presentation. And I think that might be lacking in our contemporary culture.
Yeah, interesting thought. Thank you, Mark, for that. Are we lacking in sort of role models of kindness?
Well, you know, so first of all, I think that, you know, the data are pretty clear that people are seeking kindness wisdom from different kinds of spiritual leaders like the Dalai Lama, Karen Armstrong, the Mother Teresa and the like. I'm impressed, you know, with the kindness that is practiced by popular figures. LeBron James just gave a ton of money to his old school. You know, that's profiled for young kids to see. And I'd also argue one of the most powerful forms of kindness we can be exposed to is what you started our show with in a way, Dave, which is, you know, kind of the everyday ordinary act of kindness. And I think that's one of the really interesting opportunities for places like Facebook is to start to profile, you know, just the extraordinary acts of generosity people are engaging in all the time. And we know scientifically, if I see some stranger act in a generous way, downstream I'm more generous and I feel uplifted.
So it is contagious.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, there's really nice research showing just seeing somebody be generous makes you generous in other contexts. If you work in an organization and you work in a little sector of the organization that gives a lot to charity, you end up giving a lot more to charity. So it's a very contagious part of human nature.
Kathy in Danville is going to join our conversation next. Kathy?
Hi, thanks for fielding the call. Phenomenal show. I just want to touch base a little bit on the sympathy and also the random acts of kindness. Yesterday I was in Berkeley with my teenage daughter and raising a teenager and always having them try to be very mindful and, instilling just things that make them think to do for others. I was in Berkeley on 4th Street in a tea house, and I was camping last weekend, and my neck and my back were out. And I walked in, and there was a wonderful woman sitting at the counter, and we got into a conversation. She works at Berkeley, and she's an herbalist, and the gentleman next to her is a massage therapist. Anyway, long story short, my daughter sat next to me as they, talked to me a little bit about my back, and she massaged my back, and this tea house gave me Esprit tea. And it was just such a great lesson for a teenager to see, random acts of kindness. They didn't need to do this. And it was just so, to me, it just shows the human spirit and what they're capable of. And I really appreciate the show. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kathy. Someone else who wants to write on that same sort of thing about the power of doing something small. Tisa writes, I was going through a divorce and met a friend for coffee after work. I was having a tough day emotionally. It was raining. I was late. I flew in, flustered, raw, angry. After listening to me ramble and rant for a few minutes, my friend asked for the eyeglasses I was wearing. She then gently and methodically cleaned and dried them before handing them back. It was such a small gesture of kindness on a day I was beating myself up and feeling the random distresses of life. I nearly burst into tears at the moment. I so needed someone to show me some act of love and concern, and that small gesture did the job.
You know, it's incredible. Not only do we regret the thing opportunities where we weren't kind, but we also remember those acts of generosity our entire lives.
It's something that Saunders says, to come back to that speech for a moment, where he talks about his regrets for not being kind. And then he goes on to say, or look at it from the other end of the telescope. Who in your life do you remember most fondly with the most undeniable feelings of warmth? Those who were the kindness to you, I bet. And I bet that's true for Tissa, who just wrote that. She'll remember that person who cleaned her glasses, that little act at a moment when it was most needed.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Pat in Sacramento. Pat, go ahead, please.
Hey, thank you. I appreciate this. I've been listening to the dialogue, and it's just great. It just makes me think that somehow or other it's a decisional quality to be kind, and I do believe to some degree it is. What I'm wondering about, and this is just out of my exposure to a neuropsychologist over the last 5 years in the prison I worked in, my exposure to him suggested to me that the kindness might just be in the brain. It might be in the structure of the brain itself for some people, and completely absent and completely missing in others. And I'd just like a comment from the doctor, if I could.
Pat, thank you.
Well, it is part of decision, and I think that, the decision to cultivate it. The other thing that I would say, Pat, people in prison, recent data suggests, disproportionately suffer head traumas early in childhood. And we're learning from people like Bob Knight at UC Berkeley in my department that, even surprisingly minor head traumas jostle your brain around and carve up parts of your frontal lobes that are involved in compassion. So we should be thinking very hard about the relevance of those findings about the brain processes and compassion to that kind of population.
Here's a great question from Barbara. How does one navigate being kind to the homeless? We're repeatedly told that we just shouldn't give money. So what's the best way to be kind?
Whew. I would leave that to the policymakers. I think it's a good practice to practice generosity and you see it in all cultures, the practice of alms and almsgiving. And then the people who know what the lives of homeless are like will have good answers about how to give. And there are lots of good places.
We just have a moment left, Decker. Just my last thought on how we move into the rest of our day and weekend and sort of keeping all of these wonderful stories that we've heard this past hour in front of us?
Well, I think, you know, I would think about the wisdom of the ages, which is, and I love the quote of the Dalai Lama, if you want others to be happy, practice compassion. And if you want to be happy, practice compassion. And I love that quote for a couple of reasons. One is it really shifts your focus out of the self, as Saunders' essay was advising the young graduates to do, to other people, because that's a first step. And then the other is that there are all these incredible delights in being kind. The reward circuits of your brain will light up. Your pro-social nervous system is going to be activated. Other people benefit. They will help others. It's this really powerful tool that is there every moment.
Dacher Keltner, UC Berkeley. Thanks so much for being part of our program. I'm going to close by just reading a little bit more from George Saunders' speech. He says to the young grads at Syracuse, do all the other things, the ambitious things, travel, get rich, get famous, innovate, lead, fall in love, make and lose fortunes. But as you do, to the extent you can, err in the direction of kindness. Do those things that incline you towards the big questions and avoid the things that would reduce you and make you trivial. That luminous part of you that exists beyond personality, your soul, if you will, is as bright and shining as any that has ever been. It's as bright as Shakespeare's, as Gandhi's, as bright as Mother Teresa's. Clear away everything that keeps you separate from this secret luminous place. Nurture it, share its fruits tirelessly. And someday in 80 years, when you're 100 and I'm 134, and we're both so kind and loving, we're nearly unbearable, drop me a line. Let me know how your life has been. And I hope you will say it's been wonderful. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.